On today's Promotion Man podcast with Fred Myers and L.A. Lloyd, George Benson pays for a limo for Fred's high school reunion. Why is there jazz coming from the speakers to soothe angry neighbors east of 8 Mile Road? And if you want the funk, George and Bootsy have the mothership waiting for you.
This is season two. So one of the things that I wanted to do now is I feel like we skipped over some things that I kind of want to bring back to the forefront.
Okay.
And that's kind of the lifestyle. All of a sudden, my first 6, 8, 10 months at Warner Brothers was kind of a blur because I had all these touring bands and all this stuff going on. But now my life consists of a really brilliant expense account. So I'm spending money on wonderful restaurants, buying food and hotels. And
kid in a candy store.
Yes. And then, of course, we would get hotel suites if the bands were in town, because sometimes we'd create our own little offshoot parties of places to go. But one thing that became like a constant in my life, which was awesome, was limousines.
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden, I'm renting them all the time. So I have George Benson in town, and George Benson is playing the Pine Knob Music Theater, which we bring up a lot because it was a 15,000-seater, and a lot of my bands would play 1, 2, 3 nights in a row.
Yeah.
So they'd be in front of 45,000 people in a three-day span. And so George is playing Pine Knob, and I got to be honest, George Benson, when he started singing, because his guitar playing is like no other. He's so smooth and he's so good. And he clearly came from our R&B department who started it. But when we can cross it over into top 40 radio, that's when you really start to put up some big numbers in the sales game of the music business.
Let me think of a song. Gimme the Night. Was that the
hit?
Yeah. Okay.
And Masquerade.
Yeah, Masquerade.
All right. So, and we talked about live albums, because on this podcast, we talked about how last week's episode, or no, not last week's, I'm thinking in my brain, but we had released the Bob Marley episode a few weeks ago.
Right.
And we were talking about how Babylon by Bus was the live album from the recordings of the Kaya tour. And that my Van Halen Black Sabbath tours, Black Sabbath was doing their live album, Never Say Die. So live albums became a big deal, and a lot of bands were doing them.
Why didn't Van Halen do one? I mean, that to me seemed like the perfect band to do a live album during this time, but they didn't.
Well, actually, the reason they didn't, because they were churning out studio albums at such a fast pace.
Yeah.
We were putting them out inside of a year and sometimes inside of 10 months.
Right.
And so I think once they got into the 5th and 6th album, and by then I had left Warner Brothers, and then they'd done a live album. But getting back to George Benson, so he had Weekend in L.A., which was his live album. So he was touring off of that. And he had a huge hit with The Greatest Love of All. And that went on to be the number one R&B album for 2 weeks in a row in 1978. And it sold millions of copies.
This is the same one that Whitney covered.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the next night, so let me back up. So I'm there at the show. And I'm my A&R guy, Tom, he lived in Naperville. I always thought that was funny. Naperville, Chicago. And he used to call me Sidebuster.
Okay. Like, why is that?
I don't know. Like I'm a Sidebuster or Sidewinder or something like that. It was one of those. He used to always make me laugh because I'm like just the side of a teenager and young and full of energy. And he's called me Sidewinder or Sidebuster or something. I have to figure that out. But anyway, I said to him, I said, listen, Tom, tomorrow's my high school reunion. Can I use one of the limos from tonight's show? He goes, sure, why not? He said, just put George Benson on your expenses. So I guess what I want to explain is now all of a sudden we're using limousines all the time.
Yeah.
And there's like our rock and roll limousine driver's name was Robbie. And then he's an old guy with, well, shit, like my age now.
Yeah.
You know, he had white hair and he had this hat on. And he was the sweetest guy, and he had the best laugh and even a better smile. And the things that man had seen were beyond his wildest dreams of he could possibly make up in his mind. I mean, the things he saw in the back of those limos. So So I want to explain how that works, how George Benson actually bought me a limo.
Are you sure you really want to put this out there, Fred?
Well, I don't think George is going to charge me back,
all
is he?
I don't know,
and even
man.
If he does, it makes a good story. So it's my fifth year high school reunion. So I'm out of high school like for 5 years, and they're having the reunion.
Yeah.
And it happens to be the day after a George Benson show. So I grab Robbie and tell him, hey, pick me up at my house. I'm going to get my date, which I didn't even have, but I grabbed one quickly.
I'm sure.
And so basically the way the record companies work is they kind of operate like a bank. Like, let's say, the record company's a bank, and they're going to loan you money. So they're going to loan you money to record your album.
Right.
They're going to loan you money to pay for the producer and the engineer. Then all of a sudden, when we press the records, those DJ copies we talked about in other episodes, those are all on their tab.
Wow.
When they, go crazy in a hotel room, comes back to their tab.
Yeah.
Limousines, on their tab.
Band pays for everything.
Band pays for everything. So it's basically called the chargeback. And that's why when I ran into Eddie Van Halen just on a whim in Park City, Utah one day, and I was teasing him about this ridiculous coffee table I wanted to buy. And I tried to get him to buy it for me because I said, Eddie, been together 5 years, and you're a multimillionaire. This is a badass table. What do you say? He goes, Fred, we owed Warner Brothers over $1 million on both the debut album and the second album. And that was from all these chargebacks. Remember, Joe used to do this in Friends?
Yeah.
Chargebacks.
Right.
So anyway,
trash that room and it's going to cost you. You're going to pay for it.
Yeah. So George Benson had no idea that he paid for the limo I used on my fifth high school reunion. And, I made quite the entry into my high school reunion.
I'm sure you did.
I had my Warner Brother jacket on and my, shoulder length curly hair and Robbie, the limo driver. And it was my
wow.
I think I went back one more time for a high school reunion.
Now that I think about it, and you did say that Whitney covered The Greatest Love of All, I think George is okay.
Yeah,
I think he did all right.
Yeah, he did great. So as it happens, the lifestyle now is great restaurants, phenomenal concerts that you're part of. The dinners, the parties, it was clearly booze, blow, women, and song.
That's what everybody's been waiting for you to hear for two seasons, Fred. You finally said it.
I finally admit it.
Promotion, man. He just laid it out for you right there in one sentence.
That's really what it was. And thank goodness we were in our youth so that we actually got up the next day and went back to work, the parties. So then at 23, I've got my group of friends. So not only am I working all the time, but when I'm not working and I'm coming up for air, I've got all my buddies. So I've got friends like Glenn Kirby, who ends up starting one of the real hip booking agencies that does all these new rock and roll punk bands and new wave bands.
Yeah.
So him and another friend of mine named Vince Bannon took this gay bar in Detroit called Bookies. And started booking punk bands like The Clash and The Dead Boys and Iggy and the Stooges and one of my best friends that I went to high school with. And then another buddy of mine, his name was Eric Jones. And Eric Jones is the only person I've ever known who you could go to a house party and it's rocking. And he could find a wall, lean against it, fall deeply to sleep, and stay asleep standing up against the wall. I've never seen anybody do that. But he's my rock and roll encyclopedia. When I need great questions for Wayne Kramer or some of the guests we have, I'll call him and pick his brain because he's just got the best rock and roll encyclopedia head. Then there was Bruce Wilson. Now this guy, handsome guy with the Rod Stewart shag haircut, right? So growing up in Detroit, most of my friends' parents worked for the car industry. So Bruce's dad was big time in Chrysler. So Bruce would get a menu basically twice a year, every 6 months, to order a car.
Wow.
So he could order a Charger, 440 engine, purple, shaker hood, black interior. He just check these boxes. I remember one time he got this little duster and he purposely put a 440 engine in this tiny little duster and he would do donuts, dry donuts, because when you grow up in Michigan, you do donuts in the snow and parking lot and hope to hell you're not going to hit a parking stop
right.
with your car because you're doing donuts.
Yeah.
But he was doing dry ones with this little car with this ginormous engine.
So basically you build a car like we build a computer or a phone or an yeah. iPad today.
And you want. And then they would deliver him the car to his house.
Wow.
He would beat the living bejesus out of this car, hand it in, and get another one.
Every 6 months.
So one day we're coming back from a outing where we were at this lake, and I'm driving my car and he's driving his car, and there was nobody on the road, so it must have been either super early in the morning when the sun came up, and there's no one around. So I'm driving my car, and I look to my right, and here's Bruce driving his car, and he's sitting through the sunroof, steering with his toes, and he's got the wave like this while he drives by me.
Like he's in a parade.
Like he's in a parade. He was just crazy, man. So Bruce and Glenn and I used to live together, and then they got to be too much because Bruce would like bring girls home. Well, we all did, but he'd bring them home a lot.
Right.
And somehow they'd all leave our house with a new Fleetwood Mac t-shirt or a Prince t-shirt because the record companies would put this stuff out and they weren't really available for sale, but I was supposed to give these to radio and press and DJs and he would use them, all my stash, to give to his girlfriends. So I got kind of aggravated with that whole thing and ended up moving. So my next roommate was Bill Tom, who I brought up because his dad owned the Harmony House record store.
Right.
And my other roommate's name was Chuck Papke. And our house that Bill had owned was east of 8 Mile Road. So 8 Mile Road was the dividing line between white and black, mm-hmm. and we were on the black side of 8 Mile Road.
Right.
And it was a corner house, and all of us were in the music business, so the albums in that, we had over 10,000 albums.
I can imagine.
And they would line, we took our formal dining room and turned it into the music room, so they were just deep with, against the wall. And wow. then we had record bins. And I was the guy that would actually have palm trees and hanging plants and tapestries on the wall and made the house more than just a boy's dormitory, if you will. Mm-hmm. My grandmother gave me some really cool old-fashioned furniture, which was super cool. So we would have these ridiculous parties. But what I loved about Bill in particular, because he was just a sweet guy, still is, one of my best friends, is because we would just rip it up on these house parties and we're surrounded by all these neighbors. On Sundays, he'd take the speakers out of the house, set them on the front porch, and then he'd do this amazing playlist of Count Basie or Frank Sinatra. Wow. And all the neighbors, you could see them sitting on the porch just tapping their toes. And so it was Bill's way of thanking them for being sweet to us right. and not turning us into the police all the time.
Right.
And so he would treat them to this Sunday afternoon of really
wow.
great stuff.
That's a great story.
I know, isn't it?
I love that.
Yeah. So I ended up buying Bill Tom's house. I was 23 in 1979, and my grandmother had lent me $5,000. And the house was actually $28,000.
Wow.
And because Bill got tired of our parties.
That's about what they sell for in Detroit now, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think the house may be the very same amount. But he had met a girl that he was really serious about. And at our house, you'd never know who you'd meet in the morning.
Yeah.
And we had this common deal where if I didn't introduce you to this girl, then I forgot her name. So right. it was your job to go, hey, I'm L.A. Lloyd.
Right.
And then she'd tell you her name, and then I knew who she was when I was taking her home.
Good way to go about it.
Well, we all did that. So he got tired of the chaos, so he got another place and sold me the house. A few weeks later into my tour, I've got Neil Young, and he's touring off of the Comes a Time album. So he's at Pine Knob for 2 days in a row. And meeting him was a big deal because he was part of the mega super group Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Yeah.
And if you guys have a chance to see the Woodstock documentary that's out there right now on Netflix.
It's amazing. I saw it.
It really
when
is.
I was on vacation, I watched it on the plane. It's done so well.
I think it's done because it's done in a way that, where did they get all that footage? For one, it's phenomenal.
Know. Stuff I've never seen before.
And the reason I bring that up is because Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young had never played in front of anybody. And their first live gig was at Woodstock. I mean, can you imagine? And you know, and Joni Mitchell didn't go for whatever reason, but she saw what was going on TV and wrote that really big hit about Woodstock. So anyway, meeting Neil, I think I got a little starstruck. I got a little starstruck with a lot of them, but Neil in particular, I can remember that because he shook my hand and everything kind of flashed in front of me of me and my band trying to work out those their songs and chords on guitars. And
there he is.
Yeah, and there he is. And so that album ended up charting as high as number 7 comes a time and sold millions of records. And remember, we're kind of jockeying for position here at Christmas time because this is October, November of 1978. So one of the things, too, is that Comes a Time spawned a brand new artist for Warner Brothers. Her name was Nicolette Larson.
Oh.
And the song was Comes a Time. Or no. A Lot of Love. Lot of Love. It's Gonna Take a Lot of Love.
That was a great song.
Really is.
Got played a lot on the radio.
I have a gold record for that.
That was my senior year in high school. I remember just playing, just hearing it all the time. Thought she was just awesome. And she just looked like this really cool chick. She really did.
She was. She had her little braids.
Yeah.
And she's about 5'2".
Right.
I remember taking her around radio in Houston and I locked my keys in my car in the airport parking garage, which is so embarrassing. And unfortunately, she passed away with an aneurysm at a pretty young age, quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
So the next band I had on the tour was Pat Metheny and Little Feet. I think Pat Metheny was in Grand Rapids and Little Feet were in Ann Arbor. And so I went to both shows. And of course, Pat Metheny, if you get a chance to see him or watch videos of him, I've never seen his type of jazz before. And that's the interesting thing about jazz or funk or R&B. It can go so many different directions based on that artist and their interpretation of their music.
Right.
We try to categorize this music, which is what I just did. And it's probably not, you know, always great to categorize music, but Pat is categorized as a jazz musician, but his music is just mind-boggling. Yeah. And then when they get into something and they take you with them, and Little Feet were the same way. When you got on Little Feet, when Little Feet got into it and they started to really cook with gas, I mean, really started, that train, both of them, that train was going down the track and you were on it. And you're in for a ride because there's magic going on in there and it's extremely intense. And you, when the shows are done and everyone's exhausted from the encores, you walk away and go, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's kind of funny, you know, that Pat is considered a jazz guitarist because I guarantee you there's a lot of amazing rock guitarists that wish they could play as well as Pat Metheny.
Yeah. And I think on one of our episodes, I had mentioned that I'm sitting there watching him do a sound check.
Yeah.
And Pat just goes into this dirty, seriously dirty rock and roll, like, and it was like, whoa, you know? And then he looks at me and I smile. He smiled at me and then he went right back to his little,
wow,
because they're testing their mics and they're testing everything. All right. So now I'm doing a cleanup of 1978.
Okay.
Not cleanup of aisle two. This is a cleanup of 1978. So I'm trying to grab everything before we head into 1979. So our R&B department, Warner Brothers R&B, was on fire.
Right.
Not only did they have George Benson and Chaka Khan and...
Chaka Khan.
And they had so many bands. Larry Graham. But they had the George Benson record. And then we also had that debut Prince album that we had released back in April. So now, heading into the fourth quarter, Soft and Wet was the track that it cracked the top 100, but it really actually became a top 20 R&B hit.
Right.
So really what we were doing is Prince was, we were already getting ready to put Prince back in the studio to record his Prince album, which, you know, had I Want to Be Your Lover. And that was the one that really started to kick Prince in. And we're going to do a whole episode on Prince.
Can you imagine, though, if Warner Brothers had only clumped Prince as an R&B artist? I mean, and really never pushed him to other formats, would he have still been the icon he is today?
No. And that's the key to any of these bands. I mean, let's look at Taylor Swift's career. Taylor Swift started out as a country artist.
Right.
It was her comfort zone. She was comfortable with that. She convinced her parents to move her to Nashville. And she's a beautiful young singer-songwriter that has the ability to deliver these songs that people enjoy.
Right.
And then they started getting more hooky and more hooky. And then all of a sudden, they're going, well, look, you're not as country as you are pop.
Right.
And that's really where you're going to sell the mass amount of records. I mean, kind of which brings us to, us really setting the stage for Christmas. I mean, the bunny is about to get hot. And there's just no question that the bunny is firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
And I mean, the hottest thing the R&B department had at that moment, and it was busting out like wide open, was the Funkadelics.
Yes.
The Funkadelics.
Flashlight. Neon light.
Or the album was One Nation Under a Groove.
Yeah.
The funk of it.
Getting down for the funk of it.
So they were just busting wide open. And what a crazy band. I mean, when you look at Motown, it was a lot of R&B.
Yeah.
But here, and then when you look at rock and you've got rock and roll, then all the spawns, the garage bands and the punk and the new wave. Well, black music started to go into the funk. And there was no one that was doing it better than Parliament Funkadelic.
Right.
And they were like a sister band. So in a lot of ways, I think what they did was they took advantage of the fact that they could sign two separate record deals because Parliament were signed to Casablanca.
Right, right.
And Funkadelic was signed to Warner Brothers. And then we spun off Bootsy Collins as a solo artist because Bootsy was the bass player. But Bernie Worrell was part of Funkadelics, and he ended up joining the Talking Heads and added a whole nother dimension to their sound.
Wow.
But
and Prince, I mean, he was totally influenced by George Clinton. There's no doubt about it.
There's no doubt about it. And again, these are Detroiters. Because we've been talking about Detroit. Well, Parliament, Funkadelic, Bootsy Collins, George Clinton, all Detroiters.
Wow.
And in 1978, they dominated the funk and R&B airwaves with One Nation Under a Groove, and it spent 6 weeks at the top of the R&B charts at number one with a bullet.
Now, one other thing here, that song got a lot of play in clubs because disco was so huge at that point, because funk was kind of crossing over into disco, and so, I mean,
there was like a lot Flashlight. Of,
yeah,
Flashlight
exactly.
Was a huge disco
hit. Huge club
hit. Yeah.
So there you go.
So, but you say that they were a huge influence. Well, to be honest, they were a huge influence for Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
And the G-Funk artists, and because Dr. Dre's Chronic, Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style, and even MC Hammer, Street Fighter, the original soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
and even Tupac with All Eyes on Me, all pulled from the Funkadelics.
Right.
So their live show was crazy. They had this mothership, and this mothership was a spaceship, and it was just ginormous.
It was awesome.
And it would come down from the stage rafters and land like it's landing on the moon, but it's landing on the stage. I know we're doing this podcast. We're the first time we're doing video, and I don't know if I'm talking in the mic clearly or not.
You are.
But,
you're doing fine. I'm okay. Listening. That's why I'm wearing these.
Okay.
I hear you.
So I'm looking at the mic. I'm looking at my face. So this spaceship lands, and then the whole band comes out, and they're dressed like a circus. I mean, it is a circus. It's a Funkadelic circus.
Yeah.
Parliament Funkadelic. In your face circus. And there's nothing like it. And again, another great live show in my belt because they were signed to Warner Brothers.
I'm so happy I got to see that because, you know, the only other thing I could compare that to was Boston, who kind of had a big thing that would come
out.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I'm just always been curious as a huge Boston fan. Who thought of it first? Because I got to say, whoever it was, I want to say it was probably
Funkadelics.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
No, in fact, let's, you know, if we drilled, here's the thing about these podcasts. Every time I listen to them after we're done, I just brush over so many things when I wished we had more time to talk. We don't want you guys to tune out.
Right.
So we try to keep these things about 30 minutes.
And even though a lot of it is scripted and we have our notes what we're going to talk about, there's still a lot of free form here, a lot of freestyle.
Right,
you know,
because
things will pop in my head that I want to ask you about. And
I know.
If you don't have the answer, then we clean up on aisle two.
Right. And so sometimes I wish we'd dig a little deeper because when we talk about influences, well, did Alice Cooper influence the theatrics?
Right.
I mean,
absolutely.
How many people took a guillotine and chopped their head off in front of their fans, you know? All right, so the next band I have is interesting because we had just signed them, just put their album out, and they started to hit quickly, and it was Devo. Are We Not Men?
Right.
We are Devo.
Right.
So Devo explodes on the music scene, and they would blow me away just with the way they created their interesting live show because it was part mechanics and part musicians. And clearly techno, and they had a different approach to things, so they were into the techno gear. But their stuff was hooky. And when they recut I Can't Get No Satisfaction, you know, and that became a dance track.
But I got to say, I think the band, who a lot of people may not know, but I still think the band that really influenced Devo was this band called Kraftwerk.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember Kraftwerk or not, but they kind of had that same robotic meets music kind of thing, and which I think spawned off Devo and some of the other bands that were very synth-laden in the early 80s.
You know, this may sound really crazy to you listeners and to you, but I'm almost certain Kraftwerk was on Warner Brothers.
Maybe.
And the reason I say it's kind of embarrassing is we've had so many bands.
Right.
When I get in trouble because I'm confusing modern English with Soft Cell, and they were both signed to Sire,
right.
And they both released records at the same time, stuff just starts crisscrossing.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, Dr. Dre had brought up Kraftwerk.
Oh, really?
In his, there's a wonderful documentary out with him and Jimmy Iovine that was on HBO, and it was a 6-episode deal. And the name is, I'll have to do a cleanup on it.
Okay,
but,
we'll do a cleanup.
But the deal is that he brought up Kraftwerk.
Yeah, wow.
And he even said, Dr. Dre said one of his favorite bands ever was the guys out of Seattle, Kurt Cobain.
Oh, Nirvana?
Yeah, he said that Nirvana.
How did Nirvana escape your brain?
I don't know. You know, see this gray hair? There's just so much stuff in here.
That Kurt guy.
Yeah, Kurt guy.
He had a drummer that did pretty well, too.
All right, so remember that box I told you about? I love that guy. He's the only rock band left right now. Stop making fun of me.
Sorry, we're having fun today.
So remember that box that I told you guys about where I get all these really cool stuff?
Yeah.
I almost wanted to use the word groovy.
Yeah, it was groovy.
So I get all this really cool stuff. So in this box is this yellow suit, and it's in plastic. I take it out. It's made of paper, and it says Devo on it.
Oh.
And then there's this red hat that looks like a flower pot, but it's upside down and even has a little elastic if you want to put it on your head and keep
it there
in case you're in a windy scenario.
Yeah.
Don't want to lose your hat.
Right.
So my hair is thick, curly hair down to my shoulders. And I put this stupid Devo suit on and make the girl I'm dating at the time do the same thing. But I couldn't get the hat on my head because it was just too awkward and too silly. But her and I dress up as Devo, and then we have 3D buttons, you know, that, you know, can mesmerize you if you're stoned. And we're in East Lansing promoting Devo outside of a record store, like two dinglings.
Yeah.
So on our website, promotion-man.com, I will put that picture. And
you have that?
I do. Do I have it up there?
No, I'm saying you have
it. Oh,
that
yeah,
photo.
I have a picture of it.
That's great. I want to see that.
In fact, I got to tell you, we were on our way to Ann Arbor, and we're taking these old country roads. And we didn't take the suits off for whatever reason. It's probably fall in Michigan's pleasant weather.
Yeah.
So she's wearing hers, I'm wearing mine, and we're rocking out in the car. and I see these milking cows hanging by a fence.
Yeah.
So to impress her, I pull over. And I'm in my Devo suit, and I sing to the cows, and they all come at me. And they all come at me like I'm, you know, their shepherd.
Right.
And it was the funniest thing, or I guess you had to have been there.
But, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway.
I was expecting you to say you actually milked one of the cows.
No, but that made that girl laugh, and that worked really well for me. All right, so to close out the show today, I want to talk about having Van Morrison in Detroit, because I don't know anybody that doesn't have Van Morrison in their short list of records they're going to play. Your Desert Island albums, doesn't really matter. Road trips, everyone listens to Van Morrison. My daughter, Lauren Alex, she just loves Van Morrison.
Yeah.
And I don't know too many people who don't. So when we signed Van Morrison, he was signed to Polygram or Polydor, and we were able to sign him to Warner Brothers. And at that moment in time, I try not to say negative things about people, because I think people say, hey, who is the worst person you were ever with?
Yeah.
And I have to say, all right, have you ever been grumpy? I've been grumpy before. And imagine having the flu or a cold or just being tired.
Right.
And you're on the road and everybody wants a piece of you. And everybody's asking you something, and every, you know, and it's just like, when does it get to where you're like, enough? So I reserve the right to not say anything negative about someone else, because they could have been grumpy.
Right.
But Van Morrison.
But he's been grumpy a long time.
Van Morrison was grumpy. He's a straight up grumpy guy.
So, but his music is so sweet and
awesome.
So loving and caring.
It's just great.
So let the outside be whatever it is, but we know what at least is on the inside.
Yeah. Well, so the album that we had was Wavelength.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, because my partner, Richard Woollott, he would just love Van Morrison. And he said, man, that was when I first got laid. You know, very first time to a brown-eyed girl.
Yeah, I bet it was a brown-eyed girl.
Or something. So, anyway, Van played the Masonic Temple in Detroit. And clearly his stage presence and his band, and it was just hit after hit after hit. But, you know, he wasn't doing any meet and greets, which is what we call taking people back to meet them, is the meet and greets. And and when you go to concerts, you see people with the backstage passes on their knee, usually, or their chest. That's what it's for. So the Wavelength album was the only single that actually was strong on that album. It wasn't really a very deep record. But with my list here that I got to read to you guys, we are now bearing down on Christmas. So, I mean, at this moment in time, Warner Brothers has over 25 albums climbing the charts, and most are busting the top 50.
Wow.
And I'm talking, we're going to release Doobie Brothers Minute by Minute, which ended up earning them a Grammy. We're going to release Rod Stewart, Do You Think I'm Sexy? I mean, days before Christmas.
Let me interrupt. The very first 45, for those of you who don't know what a 45 is, it's a single that's on vinyl. That is the very first 45 I ever played as a DJ. Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Really?
Yeah, there you go.
You know, it's funny, because I'll never forget getting the albums. We would get these boxes coming in, and those are those DJ copies. So I would open them and open up the box and pull out the cover, and there it would be. And it just blew my mind that I had hitchhiked around the country when I was a kid out of high school, and ended up running into Rod Stewart in a concert venue, outdoor concert venue in Tempe, Arizona.
Wow.
And he was doing so much blow, and it was literally on the piano, and he'd do a spin and get at it and do a spin and come around and go back to the mic. And now I'm opening boxes of his next album that I'm working.
Right.
And I was just with him a few months prior, and he's kicking soccer balls into the crowd from the stage.
I saw that tour.
And he would kick those balls all the way to the
very end. Yeah.
It was mind-boggling. Yeah. You know, what a great soccer player. So we have that one. We've got Black Sabbath that we talked about, their live album, Never Say Die. Talking Heads, more songs about building and food. Little Feat, Waiting on Columbus. Van Halen's debut album, which is now in the top 25. Neil Young, Comes a Time, Richard Pryor, that we never really talked about, but his album, George Benson, Ramones, Prince, Devo, Steve Martin, which we talked about a little bit, Thin Lizzy, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Fleetwood Mac, Robert Palmer, Ambrosia, Biggest Part of Me.
Yeah.
All of these records.
They refer to Ambrosia music now as yacht rock.
Yeah, I have. Well, we had everybody. We had Christopher Cross, yeah. Michael McDonald, Ambrosia.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, it's clearly going to be a ginormous Christmas year for the Bunny. And it's actually going to be one that really goes down in the record books as one of their strongest years.
Yeah.
And this episode, just so you know, ends 1978. So the next one will be going into 1979. And there's some phenomenal bands. We had signed a band called Dire Straits. There's more. I mean, there's a lot more that we're going to be talking about for the next year.
Yeah. It's going to be good. So, hey, we're in season two, and we love it. Keep spreading the word. Make sure you give us a rating and give us your 5 stars there on Apple and Google Play and iHeart, or wherever how you consume Promotion Man. So, man, we're just getting warmed up.
Yeah, and if you guys like this visual part, because we felt like maybe we could bring this to another dimension, and this is running 35 minutes. Which I don't know if you're going to hang in there or not. But if you like this, we'll continue to do this every week as well.
Right. Absolutely.
All right, so you better shut it off.
We'll see you next time on Promotion Man.
Yeah. Peace. Be with you.
Out.
Promotion Man. The true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.